Right, so before we begin then, with permission from the most venerable Mahasangha, Silmanyan Mahansa, before we begin, let us all take a moment to pay homage to the perfect one, the undefeated one, the unvanquished one, the supremely enlightened one, our father, our guide, our master, he who teaches us to ferry ourselves across the ocean of samsara, the very reason we are all here today. As we take a moment to pay veneration to the Lord Buddha, let us also remind ourselves that this is a renewal of our pledge to our purpose. This is an oath we take to free ourselves from suffering once and for all. So now let us all take a moment to pay homage to the Lord Buddha, seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem, and observe the precepts before we begin today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
So now you know what Appamada and Sampadeda means, right? You know why we observe the precepts? You know a little bit about why we seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem? I haven't given you the full explanation yet, but that is to come. You know why we offer betel leaves before we begin a Dhamma sermon? And it's really nice now that the gentlemen who come up to offer the betel leaves, normally they make an invitation. Swami Nansa, please accept this and deliver us from suffering. So you understand what the betel leaves symbolize. It is very important that when we do things, we do them with meaning. Because it is the meaning that makes the transformation within us. Not the action itself, but the meaning, the intention behind it. If intention is karma, then intention is everything. You've heard this, you know, that there's a thing called subliminal messaging. It's used a lot in advertising. Do you know what I'm talking about? Subliminal messaging. I see a few nods this way and a few nods this way, so that's... Subliminal messages, you see them all the time on the TV and newspapers, on billboards. So it's basically when you're trying to say something but there's an underlying message which is not conspicuous, but it's there nonetheless. Apparently it is there to influence your subconscious mind. So in psychology they talk about this, the superficial and the subconscious mind. So it's as if there are two minds that operate at the same time. Subliminal messaging. And people believe that subliminal messaging was an invention by modern man for commercial purposes and to further their interests. Not just for commercial purposes, but to get their point across, but not directly, but rather indirectly. Do you know what this is? You've seen me holding this right from the beginning. I did promise you from time to time I'll remind you the meaning behind all these things. This is subliminal messaging. I'm trying to tell you something, but without actually expressing it out in words. What do we call this? I don't know what the English word is, frankly. Call it a fan. Fan? But in Sinhalese we call this a vatapatra. Subliminal message. I've always held this to my chest. Always held it on display to you. You always thought that it's just, you know, something a Swami Mahansa uses. You know, like his robe, his arms, bow. He also carries a vatapatra when he goes around, especially when you're preaching. There is more than what meets the eye. So today I'm going to let you in on something, a little secret, what this vatapatra is. Vatapatra. There's a reason why this is called a vatapatra. It symbolizes the journey that you take in samsara. Now this one is it's a pretty decent one, but you'll have seen more elaborate vatapatras, haven't you? Those that are they're embroidered around, like very colorful, and sometimes red, orange, gold. Right? They usually go on the periphery or on the circumference, right? On the perimeter. Then, on the inside, you have this, palmyra, yeah, leaf, the pala leaf, and that is usually a white color. And then, it is constructed in a way that there are these lines that all center at one point. Right? So, no matter where you start, I'm pointing from behind, this is pointless. I should point this way so you can see what I'm pointing at. No matter where you start, all these lines, they converge on this one point. And then you come to this central point, which is a handle, okay? And this handle leads this way, down to the Swami Nansen. This is your journey in samsara, in a fan, subliminal messaging. Now, as I've said earlier, a moment ago, these vatapatras, or vata-atta, either way, they usually come in very ornate colors, don't they? Right? Very colorful. This symbolizes you in your lay life. Very colorful. A lot of variety. In the name of, for the sake of happiness, all the things that you do, numerous and various. Just think for a moment about how different you all are from each other. Right? Different walks of life, different things you do to engage yourselves, different things you do to entertain yourselves. Right? Now here, of course, you are dressed in white, but outside these four walls, right? If we asked for you to gather for some other purpose, maybe if you had a party, you're all going to come dressed very colorfully. All these colors symbolize and represent your mindset, because you like variety, you like numerousness, you like to be colorful, because it is those colors that you use to represent your internal thinking, your thoughts, right? After a while, you continue to listen to the sermons, you continue to listen to the Dhamma, you practice the Dhamma, and at some point, you shed all those colors. And then you come to a single color. That is the color you're all clad in today. What is that color? White. So every vatapatra you take, including this one, it is colorful on the outside, But as you go in, it is white. Now this white doesn't just represent the color you're clad in, but it represents the transformation that happens within your mind. You stop looking for that colorfulness. You stop looking for variety, because you begin to understand that happiness is not out there in the numerous and the various things that you've been doing all your lives. So this is the transformation that happened within me. You want to hear my story? This is that transformation. And they all converge here. So you see these lines? What this represents is, no matter where you start, and it doesn't matter where you start, whether you start rich, wealthy, kings, emperors, or you start as peasants, poor, hardly managing to make ends meet, struggling in life, matters not where you start, whether you start up, down, or somewhere in middle, we all come take the same path down to the center. So you see, now with monks, no matter where we start, after we've entered our ordained life, we're all the same. So much so that we even give up our names. Now usually the names are, you know, they are important to people because they carry your it is a representation of your hereditary, isn't it? It tells you where you're from. It tells you who your ancestors are, right? It talks about who you are and who you are from and so on. This is your lineage, right? It talks about all that. That is why sometimes, you know, when you, for instance, you're looking for someone to marry your son off, your daughter off, you look for who's who, right? Their family tree. And who are they related to? You know, what that name symbolizes? Are they up country or down country? You know, these are some of the questions that you sometimes ask yourselves. Are they of high caste or low caste? Not so much in our country, but in other places, you get a lot of that. So, but when we make that jump, it matters not where we start, we're all the same. Because we stop seeing the superficial differences and we start seeing the underlying commonness between all of us. Because actually, if we just remove your minds from these bodies, all that is left is a mind that suffers because of ignorance and attachment. So therefore, it becomes your purpose to free yourselves from ignorance and attachment. And that is why we all have the same thing to do, nothing else. The Noble Eightfold Path is the only path that exists for all of us, no matter where we start, no matter where we come from. Ekayano ayam bhikkave maggo sattanam visuddhiya soka pariddhavanam samatikkamaya dukkha domanasanam attangamaya nyayasa adhigamaya nibbanasya sacchikiriyaya yadidam chattaro satipatthana. There is only one path. So liberation for all sentient beings. And that is why they all converge to that one path, no matter where you start. Just look at yourselves for a second. Think about where you all come from, but you're all here today, right? See, you're all converging. Week by week, you're all converging onto one path. Now for some of you, eventually, when the time is right, when the stars in the skies have aligned, perhaps if the auspicious moment arrives, maybe if merit is in your favor, perhaps you will complete that journey of transformation, as I have done. But this is only a physical transformation. What is more important is not this. It is more important to become a monk by attitude than to become a monk in the way you dress. Monkhood is an attitude. It is your approach to life. So you can all come to that single path, the Noble Eightfold Path. So there you go. Subliminal messaging. It wasn't invented in the late 20s. It was been with us from a very long time. Go back as far as you remember, or as history might account, all the way back when monks used to preach the Dhamma, they'd always carry one of these with them. They'd hold them in their hand, constantly reminding you what your purpose is. Shed away your differences, unite, engage in the Dhamma, and converge on one path, that one path that leads you to Nibbana. That is what we are here for. More secrets later. I can't give it all at once, can I now? So now you understand the betel leaves, you understand the vatatha. Maybe one of these days I'll teach you why I wear a robe, what it symbolizes. You want it now? No. First you should be ready for it. What good is me teaching you what a robe is if you're not ready to jump into one? You want to know how cold the water is? Why? Or how warm the water is? Why? You've got to be prepared to jump into it first. Otherwise, why ask? Why bother asking? The day will come, don't you worry. The flowers that you offer, they carry great meaning. The joss sticks, the oil lamp, they carry great meaning. The food that you offer, we talked about this just before you came to the monastery for the Dakshinayapinkam, right? I explained to you why we offer food and why in front of a concrete statue. I explained to you that this is not the Buddha. That the Buddha that we worship, venerate, make offerings to is not an individual. It is the great qualities amassed. That is what the Buddha is. I told you, I am not the Mahasangha. I only represent the Mahasangha. The Mahasangha are a collection of virtues, infinite virtues. And so is the Dhamma. So you see, in our culture, and you should be very proud of that, right? Everything we've done, right from our, you know, when our ancestors adopted these practices, these rites, these rituals, because they associated the Mahasangha back then. It's not like today where people don't hardly have any time. They see their bank managers more than they see the Mahasangha. When you look at a society, you can understand what people value more or most. Back then, people weren't so busy, which gave them the time, the freedom to engage in their spiritual upliftment. It gave them time to free themselves from suffering. You might think that even in today's day and age, this is what people are doing, they're freeing themselves from suffering. But there's a difference, and I'd like to talk to you about that difference today. What is the suffering that people do generally, and what is the suffering that the Buddha talked about? Because it seems like money, wealth, right, the material gains, the material possessions that we have are the things that free us from suffering. Does it not seem like that? Does it not seem like that at least? Isn't that why people go after it so much? I myself was one of them. Right? I thought the money in the bank, money in my pocket was the answer to my suffering. See, there are two ways in which you can tackle suffering. Two ways. One way is a means to an end. If you take that path, suffering will be done forever. The other way, it seems like you're getting a break from suffering, a release from suffering, but it is not a permanent answer. It is a very temporary measure, and even that is actually not freedom from suffering, but rather a moment of respite between two moments of suffering. Let me explain. And I want you to understand that this distinguish these two things clearly before you leave today, because I think it will help you jump leaps forward on your path and in your practice in the Dhamma. how do we distinguish the suffering and the happiness that we seem to be able to enjoy through our materialistic gains and possessions, and what is this, the suffering or the happiness that the Buddha speaks of, for which you don't need anything? Because all the Dhamma that we talk about, you know, the mind, how the mind works, the Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, all of that is for this. So, you know, we talk about the Dhamma, we go into great depths. I mean, we've only started scratching the surface, but soon enough we'll start going into further depths in the Dhamma. We mustn't forget that all that is for one thing and one thing alone: to give you the answer to the riddle of life. You are all riddled with it. We are all. Until you come across the Buddha's teaching, you're riddled. See, a simple example of that would be, take a hobby that you have, whatever your hobby is. For some of you it might be drawing, some may be music, some may be, you know, sport. For others it might be watching films, reading books, cooking, right? If these are things that you do because it makes you happy, then really you should only be happy, have to do it once, shouldn't you? If something makes you happy, you should only have to do it once. How many times do you think you're going to have to become an arahant? What do you think? How many times do you think you're going to have to become an arahant? Once. That is my evidence and my proof that that is the only way, the path to true happiness. Because you only got to do it once. Everything else you do, you have to keep doing it over and over and over again. Which is proof that it doesn't really make you happy. It is only a temporary fix. This is why you are exhausted. Don't you feel that way? Sometimes, you know, maybe even right now, perhaps, you know, every Saturday or Friday, you know, everyone looks forward to Friday. And you have the Monday feeling, and then you come close to the end of the week, you have the Friday feeling. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. And you have TGIF. You know what I'm talking about. Why do you look forward to Fridays? Because you're exhausted. Exhausted doing what? Exhausted trying to be happy. Being happy and trying to be happy is not one and the same. They're very different things. It's almost like people are cursed. They're riddled. In the name of happiness, people do all sorts of things. But they never stop to think whether what I'm doing is the right thing to be doing. And the reason for that is you never took lessons from the right people. Don't you believe me? Let me prove it to you. Do you recall when it was time to do your O-levels or your A-levels, right? You look for maybe a tuition master. Say you wanted to do physics, then you'd need a master to teach you physics, right? You'd go out looking for their qualifications, won't you? Because before you find yourself a teacher, I'm not talking about the school teacher, because the school vets the teacher, you know, they check their qualifications and all that. But if you want to get some tuition, private tuition, say maybe you want to do it for your children, right? You'll make sure that they're qualified, right? So you're now looking for someone, a teacher, to teach you A-level physics. Yeah? This is the example. What is the minimum qualification they must have? What do you think? If you want to learn A-level physics from them, what is the minimum qualification they must have? Scholarship. Grade 5 scholarship. Then? Grade 8? 10? Okay, they've done their A-levels but they've failed. Or they've taken an A-level in art. Yes? Would you? No. So what is the minimum qualification you'd look for? At least a bachelor's degree in physics, because that is when you have confidence that they know what they're talking about. Otherwise, what confidence can you have? See how wise and thoughtful and intelligent you were in looking for an A-level physics teacher. But what about when you needed advice on how to be happy? Who did you take advice from? What qualifications did you check? Did you check if they were happy? You got advice from your uncle, who you overheard having an argument with his wife a week ago. If he was happy, why did he have that argument? You got advice from maybe someone 3 years, 10 years, 15 years your elder, but he got caught drug smuggling. If he was happy, if he is happy, then why that? Just take a moment and think about the people that we've gone to seek counsel, to get advice on life, to get advice on how to be happy. Did we ever check their qualifications? No. So why do you think then whatever efforts you've made thus far in life have been a failure? Because you took advice from the wrong people. If you take advice from people who are not happy in themselves, how do you expect to be happy? Perhaps you might take advice from someone who is a professional. Maybe they've gone to the pinnacle of their profession. They've gone to the pinnacle of their profession, but they're still not happy. Doctors, are you happy? Then why are you here? I have to ask that question. Forgive me. What have you come here looking for? Happiness. If you are happy, why are you here? But if you want to get advice on life, how to be happy in life, you go looking for a doctor. You go looking to an engineer, maybe a civil engineer. Ask him, Uncle, when I grow up, I want to be someone like you. That's going to make me happy, isn't it? Oh, yes, Putta. Right? This is how you got to plan your life. These are the courses you got to take. These are the grades that you've got to get. Go and get yourself some good experience, right? And then here's the path that I'm going to chart you a path, a course to get you up to success in life, right? And you can go from riches to riches, and you can be happy, just as I am. But you don't stop to ask, so why did you have a fight with Auntie last week? You don't stop to ask that. I saw you going mad with your little one the other day. Why was that? Now you were really annoyed, you were really bothered, you were really frustrated. I saw you beating the little one up. Why was that? Was that because you were happy? If you need a plumber, won't you check for their qualifications? There's a carpenter. He's very good in his carpentry skills. Are you going to have him round to do your plumbing? Would you? What about the doctor? Do you think you'd invite the doctor to come and fix your plumbing for you? No, you see. So whatever course in life you take, right, if you want someone to give you some advice, some counsel, or do a job on your behalf, won't you accept and believe and agree with me that you will always check their qualifications? Except where one thing is concerned. What a pity. If you go out and eat at a restaurant, you might check how many Michelin stars have they got. Right? Are they a well-known chef? Right? Is he a qualified chef? If you hire a butler, you check their qualifications. If you hire a chauffeur, you check their qualifications. If you hire a childminder, you check their qualifications. If you hire a teacher, you check their qualifications. If you hire a dentist, you check their qualifications. Someone says, I'm a good heart surgeon. Let me open my mouth. Please, can you check my teeth for me? You don't say that. You never say that. Even when you go to the hairdresser, you check their qualifications, don't you? That's why they've got all their accolades around the walls. Their certificates, their diplomas, their degrees, and all their work, the good work they've done, their albums, they lay it out in front of you so that you can have a look at it and be impressed and be assured that you're in the right place. Right? But when it comes to happiness, how do I be happy? Who did you ask? Did you check their qualifications? No. Is it any wonder then that you still haven't figured out? When are you going to ask? Well, that is why you are here. We should ask him how to be happy. Because he is happy. He is qualified to give you the answer. He is fully qualified. Because there is nothing in this world that can ruffle his feathers. There is nothing in this world that can upset him. There is nothing in this world that can bother him, annoy him, frustrate him, disappoint him, make him cry, or angry, or sad, or disappointed. See, he is qualified to give us advice on how to be happy. That is why he says, Ekayanam bhikkhave ayam bhikkhu madhu. Soka pariddhavanam samatikkamaya. To get rid of all fears and all grief. Dukkha domanasanam attangamaya. To free yourself from all suffering, absolutely, comprehensively, categorically. Nyayasa adhigamaya. To come to realization. Nibbanasa sachikiryaya. To attain Nibbana. Chattaro Satipatthana. The Satipatthana. This is the path. Now I know when I say the word Satipatthana, some of you will tremble at the sound of the word. Oh God, this is going to get very heavy today. Don't worry. It doesn't have to be. You know, in my studies of the Dhamma, right? I've studied the Suttas, I've studied the Abhidhamma, I've studied the Vinaya, right? Back then I thought that learning a lot of Dhamma is going to free me from suffering. I think I shared this story with you. When I was at Dhamma school, preparing for my Dharmacharya, I was very fond of the Abhidhamma. Wherever you'd see me, if I had a spare moment, I'd be with my Abhidhamma books in my hand. Reading them, studying them, memorizing them, right? All the chittas and the chaitasikas and their concomitants and how they would work together, the combinations that they would make and the results of that. Excuse me. Forgive me, from time to time I have a bad throat. And then the planes in which they take fruit, right? And so on. So the more Abhidhamma I learned, the more Dhamma I learned, just generally, the more Dhamma I learned, the more I felt that I was becoming holy. In fact, after Dhamma school, you should have seen me. On the way to Dhamma school, I was a normal guy. On the way back from Dhamma school, every Saturday, I used to have Dhamma school on Saturday. I was like holier than thou. I felt like I had... What do you call them things, on those rings on your head when you are holy? A halo, yes. I felt like I was almost sporting a halo on my head. But soon enough I began to realize that learning the Dhamma is one. It's good. It's good to learn the Dhamma because it helps you to better understand some of the concepts that we talk about. But learning the Dhamma is not the same as freeing yourself. Liberation is not the same as learning the Dhamma. For that you need the Noble Triple Gem. One of the most important aspects of the Noble Triple Gem is the Sangha, and that is not me. I'm not saying that a monk is very important in your life. I'm saying Sangha is your practice. It is your practice. If Buddha is your destination, Dhamma is the path, Sangha is your practice. Let me say that again. If Buddha is your destination, Dhamma is the path, Sangha is the journey that you take, your practice on that path to get to Buddha. That is why you will all eventually become Buddhas. Not necessarily Sammasambuddhas, but Arahata Buddhas. Sangha is a practice. And that practice, part of it is the understanding of the Dhamma. The other part of it is the transformation that we make by becoming better human beings. You might wonder, why does Swaminarayana come here? He talks about, he wants to guide us to Nibbana, but he's talking to us about respecting and looking after our parents. So you might wonder, why is Swaminarayana talking about respecting your elders and, you know, being a good citizen and being loyal and, you know, looking after your wife, looking after your husband, being a good spouse to them, being loyal to them, being truthful to them. Why is all that important? Because it is all part of Sangha. Sangha is just not donning a robe. Sangha is this. This is Sangha. It is the transformation that happens within you. Look at the Sutta Pitaka, for instance. The Buddha gives a discourse on something called the Vasala Sutta. It's a very important discourse. He defines who a Vasalaya is. Now in those days, Vasalaya was considered to be someone who was of low caste. Right? So people, some bright man, saw the Buddha one day and said, "Hey Vasalaya, come here." So that is how we refer to the Buddha. So the Buddha, being the Buddha, he comes up. Right? Nothing bothers him, of course. So he asks this man, "You call me Vasalaya, do you know who a Vasalaya is? Do you know who a Vasalaya is?" And he says, "Actually, come to think of it, I don't know who a Vasalaya is. Is it not just someone who is of low caste?" And then the Buddha asks, "Okay, fair enough, low caste, but what makes you low caste? What lowers you in caste?" is the question he's asking. Because in that culture, caste was something you inherited by birth. So the Buddha gives him advice. He says, "Najaccha vasalo hoti. Najaccha hoti brahmana. Kamana vasalo hoti. Kamana hoti brahmana." Young man, listen to me. It is not by birth one becomes a high caste Brahmin or a low caste Vasala, but by deed alone does one become either high caste or low caste. Really, I think what the Buddha is saying is, you caste yourself. What is your caste? I ask you now. Are you high caste or are you low caste? You never thought Swaminarayana would ask such a question, did you? In a sermon, how dare he ask what my caste is? You caste yourself. You know, like when you cast a net, right? So, you know, you get the picture of casting, right? You cast a net, so you throw the net, right? In the same way, folks, we caste ourselves. Or you can think of it as a caste. You know, something that you make out of maybe metal or, you know, a cast, right? That is your cast, not with an E at the end, just C-A-S-T, cast. Now that is a good cast to think about. Drop the E. What is your cast? So in Buddhism, do we not talk about cast? Of course we do. Not that kind of cast, a different kind of cast. How do you cast yourself? How do you conduct yourself? So the Buddha goes on to explain. One of these days I'll give you a full exposition of the Vasala Sutta. So we can transform ourselves from low caste to high caste. We all began low caste. Mattered not whether you were born to an aristocratic family or to a family of a peasant. At some point we were all low caste. But our actions uplift us. Our thinking transforms us. It raises us up. Our intentions raises us up, elevates us to high caste. A simple one example of this, the Buddha says, one who is capable of but does not look after their parents in their late years, when they're feeble, when they're weak, when they're elderly, is by my definition a what? A vasala, a low caste. One who is able. See how wise the Buddha is. So he doesn't just say one who doesn't look after their parents is of low caste. He says one who is able to and doesn't. Means you have the means to do it. You have your arms, you have your legs, you have the means to earn, make a living, right? You have enough for yourself, your family, but you have enough to also look after your parents. Like I told you the other day, I used to work in a nursing home when I wanted to be a doctor back then, many moons ago, right? And I recall how there were patients there who had been completely rejected by their children. They had the means to look after them, but they didn't. They were suddhas and suddhis. Does that make them high caste? Because it is not by birth one becomes high caste. It is not birth that determines your caste. It is not your parents that determine your caste. It is possible for parents to be of low caste, but for their offspring to be of very high caste. That is all important in the practice of Sangha. On the path to Nibbana, ladies and gentlemen, you know, our minds should be a fountain of compassion. That is what Nibbana is. Oftentimes people ask me this question, like especially the regulars who come to our Saturday sermons, right? Nowadays I think they've gotten used to this, but now those days they used to ask, Swaminaza, how do I know I'm making progress on the path to Nibbana? You know, we've been coming along to your sermons for like so many weeks now, right? How do I know that I'm making progress? How do I know that this is working for me? What answer do you think I give them? Do you think I ask them, okay, name the 89 chittas, here's a test, or the 28 rupas? No. I don't give them a test in the Dhamma. I give them a test of humanity. That's what I give them. A test of humanity. Are you human? Are you humane? In the face of other people's suffering, do you feel that you have a part to play? Do you feel that it is your part to go and do something about it? Do you melt when you see other people suffer and feel like you have to do something about it? Are you full of karuna? Are you full of metta? Are you a fountain of mudita? These are the questions I ask them. So if you keep coming along to these sermons, ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you now, this is the transformation I expect from those who are my students. If you consider yourselves to be students of this teaching, right, then this is what I expect from all of you. I'm never going to give you a test in the Dhamma, don't you worry. From time to time, perhaps in the future, right, when we've gotten some far in our discourses, maybe I'll bring down a few monks from the monastery, split you up into groups, and we can discuss how far you've understood the Dhamma. We do that at the temple, at our monastery, every Saturday. At the end of every sermon, a number of our monks, they sit down with the people, the devotees, the listeners who come to the sermons, and in groups they discuss. Ensure that they have taken the gist of the sermon. Ensure that they have understood the Dhamma, the teaching. They ask questions, they give answers, they cross-question, right? So, when we are ready for it, perhaps that is something we can do here one day. But let's say, in that test, you give all the right answers. You give all the right answers. But your husband still complains about you. Your wife still complains about you. How you are still breaking things at home when you go mad. When you're just still smashing things, when you're still, when the dog at home knows that you've had a bad day at work, if Tommy is still complaining, if Tommy knows that you've had a bad day at work, then who's the real dog? I have to ask. Because when Tommy has a bad day of at work, you know, he doesn't take it out on you. That internal transformation is what is important. But that is why we study the Dhamma. So that is not to say that we should not study the Dhamma. We must study the Dhamma. And some of you will be engaged in further practice. Maybe you read up on the Dhamma. Maybe you study the Suttas. Maybe you study the Abhidhamma. Perhaps some of you are even interested in the Vinaya. That's fine. It's perfectly fine. But what we come here for is the internal transformation. This is not a test of the Dhamma, but it's the test of how human you are. Are you a fountain of compassion, loving kindness? Are you willing to sacrifice your comforts for that of others? How difficult is it for you to do that? These are the questions. These are the ways in which you can estimate and understand, evaluate yourself. You know, maybe perhaps 6 months ago, maybe several weeks ago, maybe a year ago, right? It was very difficult for you to make sacrifices, to make adjustments in your routines, to make adjustments and amendments in the way you plan your day out. If you've planned your day, it has to be that way, and everyone else has to conform to that. But I assure you that soon enough, if you keep on doing this practice, if you keep on practicing Sangha, soon enough you will become a blessing to be around. People will love to have your association. They'd love to have you around. Aren't there people like that? Have you never come across people like that? They're just such a blessing to be around. It's always so nice to have them around. They're always so cheerful, always has a smile on their face. Nothing bothers them. They're always just so cheerful, so lovey, right? They're so happy. There are people like that. Now, whether that is through an understanding of the Dhamma or not, that is not for us to decide. But if you are not that person, then, well, it's time we start to make that change. After all, you know, the success of our lives should be determined by the influence and the impact that we made on the lives of others, mustn't it? What do you want to be remembered for when you are gone one day? For the money in your bank account or the hearts that you have healed? Which one? The first or the second? I don't think it's a question that's even worth asking an audience like this. What matters more to you? Your educational qualifications, your professional qualifications when you're gone? Is that what you want people to be talking about? Or how you were a wonderful wife, a wonderful husband, a wonderful mother, the most amazing child that any parent could ever have wished for? Which one of these two things would you rather? The first or the second? Of course, the latter. That is what the Dhamma will do to you. And that is how you need to check whether you are progressing on the path in Dhamma. No other test will really work. So fear not whether you are a Sotapanna. Don't worry about that. Honestly, don't worry about that. Because the truth is this. You can never be 100% assured whether you're a Sotapanna or not. You can go on a hunch. You might think, I feel like a Sotapanna. But what does a Sotapanna feel like? What are you going to say? Like this, Swami Nosa, like this? So don't you come and ask me, Swami Nosa, am I a Sotapanna? Have I become one? Am I close? How many more sermons, Swami Nosa? How many more sermons to becoming a Sotapanna? Cut it out. Don't come here for any of that nonsense. Don't come here to become a Sotapanna. Come here to become a better human being. To live a happy life. To be a blessing to others. That is how I guide myself. Why does it care if I'm a Sotapanna but I'm just a bother to be around for other people? Imagine I'm a Sotapanna but I always undermine other people when I talk to them. I'm a Sotapanna, I walk around telling people, you're not a Sotapanna, are you? I'm a Sotapanna. Aren't you even a Sotapanna? I'm a Sotapanna. Treat me properly, treat me well. I don't eat in this plate. Give me another plate. Give me a Sotapannish plate. Why do you serve me drinks in these cups and saucers that everybody has? Give me a special one. I'm a Sotapanna. Do you like a Sotapanna like that? Do you think that is... Oh God. That is a Sotapanna. I don't want any Sotapannas like that in my audience. And I know that will never happen to you, because you're taking the right path. This is an internal transformation. Right? The best test of whether these sermons are working for you is ask the people you live with. Am I a nicer person to be around? That is the best test. When you get home, ask your husband, honey, you know those days you used to complain about this, that and the other. how I would be so fixed on something when I make my mind up about something, and I would never budge, and you would always complain that, you know, if I decide to go somewhere or do something, I have to do it, and if it's my way or no way, right? You always used to say that. Am I still the same? Or have you not begun to realize that something is changing about me? Am I a better wife to be with? Are you happier when you are with me? This is the question to ask. That's the question to ask. Why do we love people like Mahatma Gandhi? Tell me. Because he was a Sotapanna? No. Because of their temperament. They were just wonderful human beings to be around. They were not Vasalas. That's why. Why do people talk about Mother Teresa? Why do they call her Mother Teresa? Her name was only Teresa. Why Mother? Because people sensed motherly love and affection from her. How about if you can conduct yourself in a way that people start calling you that? Whatever your name is, if the people who live with you, folks, you know, begin to feel, not just your children, but your siblings, your neighbors, your friends, your co-workers. If they start to feel that you are like a mother, just an abundance of love and kindness and compassion, always willing to go the extra mile for somebody else, cares so little about oneself but cares so much about others. See, even to this day we talk about these great people. Why do we still talk about them? It is not because of what they took from the human race, but because of what they gave to the human race. Their advent into this world, their coming into this world, lifted us up as a race. If there are an alien species somewhere out there, right? From time to time, if they took a check to see how valuable humans are as a species, when we have people like Mother Teresa, Mahatma Gandhi, Florence Nightingale, when we have people like that come and go, they realize that in these times, in these periods, in these eras, humanity as a race, they are lifted. They shine so bright. In the time of the Buddha, you'll have read many a sutta where the gods come down to the world, to the human plane. And they were to be seen here and there. Because even to divine beings, this place was a paradise. It is to achieve that sainthood, the Dhamma we must use. And nothing more than that. So this is not preparing ourselves for an exam. This is not preparing ourselves for a test. That's why I don't just come here, sit down and start first lecture, lecture 2, lecture number 3, please make notes, right? Get this recording, go back and listen to it, and you have a test in 3 weeks' time. No. This is not an academic approach to the Dhamma. This is a very practical approach to the Dhamma. If there's anything you can offer me to make me happy, ladies and gentlemen, it is not the pirikara that you offer me. That doesn't make me happy. It is not the alms that you offer me. In fact, it's not the alms that you offer me that makes me happy. It's your intention to give. That is what makes me happy. The intention to give, the gift of giving, that is what makes me happy. If there's anything that you can offer me that makes me happy, lay down at my feet if you can what others have started to say about you. But they have to be genuinely true accounts of what other people have started to say about you. If your mother, if your father are now starting to say that my son, he's a different boy altogether. He used to be so headstrong, he used to be so decided on things, and you know, he would never change his opinion about things, and he'd have no concern or consideration about his father or mother. Right? He'd always be the one who'd have to have the first of everything. But now, he always shares with his brother. Even when he has little, he'll still share. And ever since he started listening to the sermons, I've never seen him have anything alone. Even if it's just a piece of chocolate, he'll still share it with everyone else in the family. I've never seen this in him, Swami Nuansa. That I like to hear. That is what I like to hear. That is more than any pirikara can please me. That is the pirikara. Your transformation. Because then I know that these sermons have been worthwhile. We have been able to achieve something together. If your co-workers are able to, when they have a bad day, when they have a tough day, if they're able to seek in you some solace, if they're able to share their burden with you and feel relaxed, that is what I like to hear. It's how many hearts you've healed. Simple as. Because we are children of the Blessed One, ladies and gentlemen. We are disciples of the Blessed One. He was a blessing. He was a blessing to all of us. His presence was a blessing. Everywhere he went, every person he talked to, every heart he healed, man or beast, if ever they came across him, only good would come to them. If you can be someone like that. You know, I say this in a jesting way, but you know how we used to say, if someone would come and mess with you, you're messing with the wrong person, you're messing with the wrong guy. How about we change ourselves so that if someone comes and messes with you, you can say, you're messing with the right guy. How is that possible? It's possible because, and it's possible how, if and when someone comes up to you and starts messing with you, only good will happen to them and never bad. You threaten them, you're messing with the wrong guy, you better keep your distance. That is how you used to be perhaps. We all have that ugly past in our lives. You're messing with the wrong guy. How about the Buddha? What do you think? Was he the wrong guy to mess with? He was the perfect guy to mess with, wasn't he? What did Angulimala try to do? He tried to mess with him, didn't he? Yes. Now what happened? Nothing but goodness. Goodness gracious. That is the objective of these talks. Not simply to impart knowledge in the Dhamma to you, but to make you all shine. Shine bright. So that even the devas will one day come and worship at your feet. That is what I want. So that you are not just great to your family members. You are not just great to your friend. You are not just a great husband or a great wife, but you are a great human being. And everyone knows that. not just great to mankind, but to great to Devakind as well. Great to the Brahmas. To get to that end, to that destination, Sangha must happen within you. And Sangha happens within you when you begin to understand the Dhamma. That is why then we learn the Dhamma. That is our purpose. So if ever someone asks you, why do you go to these Sunday morning sermons? Have you not got anything better to do? Right? Or if you want to invite someone to come here and listen to a talk, right? In your introduction to them, don't tell them this is a Dhammapasana, where we teach you the Dhamma. It is not a place where we come to learn the Dhamma. It is a place where we come to learn about ourselves and improve ourselves for the sake of others, so that we become a blessing to others. That is what this place is for. I want to hear people say good things about you. I want to hear that. I want to hear people say lovely things about you. That's what I like to hear. I want people to feel affection from you and towards you. That is what I like to hear, that is what I like to know. And it has already started. You don't know this. From time to time, you know, when you come here and make your veneration, I get to hear from them. Swami Nasa, this is another lady who comes with me. She was the one who brought me here. She was so kind. She was so gentle. She was so thoughtful. She brought me here. She sat me down and she said, you can do this. If I can do this, you can do this. I was initially, you know, a little bit taken aback. I wasn't decided on whether I should be coming here or not. It was a strange place, new place, a new, some people come and say, I'm of a different faith. I was initially a bit apprehensive about coming in the first place, but this gentleman, he brought me here, and now I'm all the better for it. So they say, Swami Nasa, you changed my life. I said, no madam, I didn't change your life. That person that brought you here, they're the ones who changed your life. So people have already started saying good things about you. You know, that person that you brought here, your friend maybe. Perhaps, you know, you had a spare seat in your car and you invited them to join you and you brought them along. 2 weeks, 3 weeks on, and they begin to realize something's different. I'm not the same person I used to be. I don't get agitated as much as I used to. I feel more relaxed. I feel more chilled. I feel more cool. What's going on? And they begin to realize what's going on. So that is what the Dhamma is for. Come to think of it, you know, when the Buddha taught the Abhidhamma, I talk about the Abhidhamma because Abhidhamma is considered to be like, you know, the most voluminous exposition of the Buddha, and it was given at great length, that so much that he couldn't deliver it to a human being. So there is no account of any human being having attained Sotapanna by listening to the Buddha preach the Abhidhamma. Every text you read in the Tripitaka, it is all at the end of a sutta discourse. But we study the Abhidhamma. As monks, we study the Abhidhamma because it helps us to further break this down and explain to you in ways that you can understand. This is simply for the purpose of simplification. It's like your chemistry teacher. Right? They'll go and do their reading, they do the extra reading, additional reading, they'll go looking up things on the internet, right? Do their research, and then they'll come back to you and give you the gist of it. So this is the service that you receive from me. Explore the Dhamma, go and find out, see what the Buddha had to say, see what the Arahants had to say, see what the books say, see what the scriptures say, and bring it all back and give it to you in 1.5 hours. I've never kept 1.5 hours, have I? 2 hours. That's why I say, just make sure you bring yourselves here, engage in merits, and the test of whether this is working for you should be what? Your internal transformation. Do the people around you like you? Do they enjoy your presence? Have they started saying good things about you? So I often ask people, you know, my listeners, every once in a while, maybe every few months, go and ask your loved ones. Ask your brother, Ayya, what do you think about me now? I know, you know, those days we didn't see eye to eye much, right? We couldn't settle things amongst between ourselves. But how about now? Are you feeling that I'm a different person, or am I still so difficult to get along with? You know, now there might be some of you who've had, you know, a shake up in the family. Perhaps, you know, maybe something happened a few years ago and now you don't see eye to eye. Maybe siblings who used to be, you know, like, well, they are siblings, they are still siblings, but you don't associate each other anymore. For whatever reason, maybe it was a misunderstanding and you're still waiting to see who says sorry first. Who apologizes first? Who makes the first phone call? If you're still waiting for that, be the better man. Your brother, if he's the one who was upset with you, or your sister, who was the one who walked out of the family, and now they want to come back to you, but they can't because they just don't have the guts to make that leap, to take that jump, to say sorry, to pick up the phone and say hello, to invite you around. They want to, but they can't. Now here's a moment for mudita. See? Here's a moment for mudita. Be merciful. Have mercy. If there's been a rift in the family, you be the one who settles it back again. Don't wait for them. Because, you know, that's what I'm here for. I'm here to help you do the difficult things in life. These are the most difficult things in life, aren't they? Earning a bit of money is not so difficult. Building a house is not so difficult. Driving a car is not so difficult. Going to the moon is not so difficult. Compared to what? When people have fallen apart, making myths, oh, that is incredibly difficult. Because ego, pride gets in the way. Does it not? Why should I go and say sorry? Let him. He's the one who walked out. Why should I? He's the one who didn't put his weight. He's the one who didn't do his part. So why should I go say sorry? Let me tell you why you should go say sorry. Because you are the better man. That's why. You know, there's a nice way to say sorry. Even when you know you're not wrong. You know how? I'm sorry you feel that way. See? What have you lost? Nothing. What have you gained? Everything. Is it better to go to sleep at night knowing that there are three people who don't like you? Or is it far better to go to sleep at night knowing that the whole world is your friend? Which one? If you want to sleep like I do, if you want to sleep as I do, open your heart to every man and woman out there. Make it home for them, because home is where the heart is. Make your heart their home. Even when everyone has abandoned them, when everyone has forsaken them, you still have room for them. Be the bigger man. Have a big heart. An enormous heart. That is what the Dhamma is for. That is what the Dhamma is for. So if you have someone in the family who's broken up, you know, fallen apart, you don't see eye to eye, there's been a rift in the family, maybe that happened 10 years ago. And they don't even now come for Aurudu. Next Aurudu, set down a goal for yourselves. At the next new year, I'm going to go to him or to her. I'm going to take with me a plate of sweets, whatever. Or at least give them a phone call. Right? Ayya, it's me. It's Nangi here. They will not be expecting that voice. But they want to hear that voice. They love you. But pride's getting in their way. But they don't have a teacher to guide them. You have. You have the Dhamma to guide you. So you make that phone call. You invite them over. You go to them first. With a kirihatti and a tani botalina. You go there first. Try it and see how good it will feel. You'll feel as good as I do. Because it's not a nice feeling. When you have resentments, it festers, does it not? When you have resentment towards others, it festers. It hurts. Every time you're reminded of him or her, you know, someone in the family, every time there's a family reunion, there's always one person missing. Doesn't that seem just really... Doesn't that bother you? Whenever the family gets together, there's always one person missing. That guy who walked out of the family. But years have passed now, and it's time for water to, you know, it's water over the bridge. It's just water under the bridge. Sorry, I'm mixing my metaphors here. Water under the bridge. It's time to move on. Talk to them. Use the Dhamma to help you make that jump. That is what I'm going to talk to you about. How do we use the Dhamma to free ourselves from those shackles? Those shackles keep us tight. We can't seem to move. We seem to be wound up and bound to our pride and our egos. When we know that there's a better thing to do, there's a more noble thing to do, but we can't bring ourselves up to do it because the fetters bother us. The defilements keep us down. That's why it's time to recast ourselves. Recast yourselves to a higher caste. And let's use the Dhamma for that. Right. I'm going to use this question as our segue into today's discussion. Venerable Sir, energy and the related processes seem clear. Very good. For a process to begin, you have to have the Indriya, which is the faculty. For the Indriya to be there, you need a body. Yep. For a body to be there, you need a being. Ah. Okay. Now confused. It says they're confused. They go on suddenly. Okay. Let's go back to what we know. And then we'll make our way to what we don't know. So far, we've learned about our faculties. We've learned that the mind is an instrument. Right? It's a device. A device with a purpose. And every time an object comes through our five senses or through the mind itself, it lands on the mind base and then a chitta is born. Yeah? And the chitta's purpose is aramana, vijanana, lakkana, chitta. So this is a lakkana. A lakkana is in Sinhalese lakshanaya, which is a characteristic. Okay? It's a characteristic. So the characteristic of perceiving an object is the chitta. Now, like water has the characteristic of flowing. It's a fluid. Okay? And water also has the characteristic of quenching thirst. These are all characteristics of water, of an object. In the same way, the mind also has a characteristic. It may have several characteristics. One of them is what? Aramana, vijanana, lakkana. So aramana, vijanana. That is a characteristic of the mind. And we call that characteristic the chitta. Does that make sense? Yeah? I see the full 360. Give me a nod once in a while so I know whether you understand what I'm saying. Because if you don't, it's fine. I'll say it 100 times. Right? We've got all the time in the world. The only thing we have is time, and the only thing we don't have is time. That's all we have and all we don't have. So, let me draw it on the board quickly. See, this duster has a characteristic. It has several characteristics. One, if I drop it, if I let go, it falls. That is a characteristic because it has gravity working on this. It has a weight. That is also a characteristic. It has mass. That is also a characteristic. It has length, width, breadth, right? These are all characteristics. If I hit you with this, it's probably, well, not going to hurt so much, but you're going to feel it. That is also a characteristic. In the same way, this has a characteristic called being able to erase. It can dust off. That is a characteristic. So using those characteristics, we define this as a duster. Yeah? So we define it as a duster. And the pen, again, this also has characteristics. It has a weight, it has mass, it has length, width, breadth, it has a circumference, it has a radius, right? And it can write. So to be able to write is a characteristic. By that characteristic, we define it. Because, you know, if we defined everything just by the fact that it had mass, then everything would have the same name, wouldn't it? Yeah? If we defined everything, if we named everything on the basis that they all have mass, then everything would have the same name. But we have chosen one characteristic about this object to name it. What is that characteristic? To be able to write. Therefore, we call it a pen. We have chosen one characteristic about this object to name it. And that characteristic is erase or dust off. Therefore, we call it a duster or an eraser. Now, the mind has characteristics. It has multiple, various, numerous characteristics. We use one characteristic out of all that to define it. We call it the chitta. And that characteristic is the ability to perceive objects. Fair enough? Good. So, you have the eye. You have the sight object. Can you see from the back? Is it? I can draw it bigger. Yes? Okay. Better. Something funny happened last week. At the end of last week's sermon, someone from the audience, they came and asked me, "Swami, you know, sir, I don't understand this thing about this money thing you talked about." I said, "What money?" "No, you talked about this money. Should I think about money or shouldn't I think about money?" I said, "What money, sir? I was thinking about money." Then I realized I'd written the word monkey. But it was so small. Of course, the gentleman had missed the letter K in it. So he thought I'd written money. So that got me thinking, next time I draw things on the board, I should either use a thicker pen or draw it large enough so you can see it on the back. So apologies for any inconvenience that might have caused last week. So here's the eye. And we have an object. Can you see it? Good. So the eye is an instrument that allows us to see. We know that the brain is involved. And then what's most important here is that a chitta is born. Now, we learned what the purpose of a chitta is, and that is to perceive these objects. And when the perception process happens, we know that it happens in 5 steps. So initially you have to receive the object, that is the first R. Then you have to register the object, meaning to acknowledge that it has been received. Okay. Then you have to recognize the object, identify it, then you have to respond to the object. You need to know what to do with it. Do I look at it? Do I touch it? Do I chase it? Do I turn it outside in, upside down, whatever? And then finally, once all these three, four things have happened, you get to the end result of perceiving the object. Okay? Yeah, so in the Pali, we call this Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, and Vijnana. You can choose whichever you want to use to refer to them. You can either call it Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, or you can call it this. Receiving, registering, recognizing, responding, and perceiving. The totality of this is a chitta. If you take out any one of these things, it is no longer a chitta. Because what is a chitta? It is the characteristic of being able to perceive objects. So all four of these, or all five of these, must happen for perception to take place. Now last week, we talked about the doer versus the done. Yeah, because I asked you, I asked you the question about the pen. I said, if I let go of the pen, what's going to happen to it? It's going to fall. So I asked you, who's holding on to the pen? You said, Swami Nuhanse. And who's going to let go of the pen? You said, Swami Nuhanse. Then I said, who's going to catch the pen when it falls? You said, the flow. And then I asked you, then who's falling the pen? And you had nothing to say about that. Because, of course, we understand that there is no one to fall. Falling is not a doing thing, it's a done thing. Yeah? And then I gave further examples. For instance, when I show you this pen, you can't not think that this is a pen. Right? Because if you know that this is a pen, this process will happen with or without your liking. Yeah? It does not need your will, for instance. You don't need to want to do this for this to happen. That's why you say, please don't show it to me. And then you close your eyes. Because if your eyes are open, you will see. You can't help that. Now, the eye is, of course, a physical object. See, you have to close the physical object for a mental thing to stop happening. Meaning, you can't control the mental process. Because if you didn't like to see something, and you could entirely control your mind, and if the mind was subservient to your wish, your wishes and your will, then you could still keep your eye open and still see the object, or still not see the object. You could choose to be blind, but you can't, can you? In the same way, you can't choose to not hear what I'm saying. Yes, you can shut your ears like this, but you have to physically make a change in your body. Mentally, you can't help it. What does that prove to us? That these are all processes. Because in a process, there is no doer, it's just a done. Rain is a process, there's no doer. Sunshine is a process, a rainbow. What is that? It's a process. You're not going to find elves at the end of that, trying to, you know, lighting up the rainbow. It's not how it works. It's a process. So, when something is a process, ladies and gentlemen, it is the causes that give the effect of the process. The causes keep that process in motion. Okay? So we are coming to this concept of cause and effect here. I want you to understand the significance of this concept of cause and effect. Because it is the overarching phenomenon. It covers everything. The entire universe, the entire cosmos, everything that you know of, everything that you don't know of, yet all of it is all subject to the principle of cause and effect. It encompasses everything, cause and effect. So a process is an effect of causes. Take the process of perception. See, here are the causes. Here are the causes. Receiving is a cause. Registering is a cause. Then recognizing is a cause. Responding is a cause. And then ultimately perceiving. This is a cause. When all these five things have happened, the effect of perceiving the object has happened. So much so that you can't separate the causes from its effect, can you? Let's take a simple example. Let's take a fire. What are the causes of a fire? This is basic science. You need oxygen. You need something flammable. And you need temperature. Okay? You need oxygen, you need something flammable, and you need temperature. So this is how you would light a candle, for instance. You need the oxygen. Remember the test you do it at college, you cover it with a jar and then the candle would go out to prove that oxygen was required, yeah, and that oxygen was consumed when a fire was burning. So you need all three things. Now, here's a wonderful revelation. I want you to bear this in mind for the time being. You will make use of this later on in our talks. And I'll tell you when, but for now just bear it in your mind, because there will come a point where I'll say, remember that conversation we had that day, and that will be an epiphany for you. Because you'll be so elated that this is so. What is so? Let me tell you that now. To light a fire, you need how many of these three factors? One, two, or all three? All three. You need all three of them to light a fire. But to extinguish the fire, how many of these three things must you take away? One, two, or all three? Just one. Just bear that in mind for now. It is... I can't contain myself right now. I want to say all this, but I know it's not time yet. This is like, you know, making a pudding. You can't just put everything all together at once. You have to give it time, and you have to do it tenderly and carefully and loving kindness and compassion and all that. Sometimes, you know, some things I don't tell you out of compassion, because it's just not the time yet. Like, as my teachers do, they don't tell me everything in one go. They tell me when I'm ready for it. So I'm building you up and getting you ready for what's coming next. So what was the point we just talked about? To bring an effect into life, to bring an effect to life, you need all of the factors, all of the causes. But to exterminate it, to extinguish it, you only need to take out one of them. This is why when you use a fire extinguisher, which one of these things do you take out? The fire extinguisher? So if you are using water, you take out temperature. Yeah, because water has the ability to absorb energy and evaporate, thereby reducing the temperature. Sometimes you have maybe a blanket that you throw on a fire. What does that do? It cuts out the oxygen supply, but you still have the flammable object and you still have the temperature, but still the fire goes out. See? Yeah? So to keep a fire lit, you have to keep adding wood, if it's a wood fire, for instance. And then you keep blowing it. Right? If you have a barbecue, or maybe if you're having those things you had when you were there? Campfire. Yeah? If you have a campfire, right? You blow to keep a fire lit. Why do you blow to keep a fire lit? What does it do? As you blow it, the gust blows away the ashes. And by blowing away the ashes, because it's not really blowing oxygen to it, you're blowing away the ashes. As you blow away the ashes, now the oxygen is able to make contact with the flammable object more than it used to. So therefore, sorry, that was a science lesson. I get carried away. I have to remind myself, I'm also a monk. Otherwise I'd forget, I'm a scientist in the monk. I'm also a monk. Okay. So then you only need to take out one of the causes, right, for an effect not to manifest. Now I said an interesting word there. Did you catch that? Manifest. This is a critical word that we need to understand. Manifest. The whole concept of anicca one of the three teachings of the Buddha. Then you'll ask, is that all the Buddha taught us? Three things. No, if you distilled all he taught, the purpose of his instruction, you could boil it down to three things. It is said, Nahi Silena Vatanghotu Upajanti Tathagata. The Tathagatas don't come into this world to teach us about rites and rituals and practices and religion. That is not what the Buddhas come into this world to teach us. Attakara Tini Pada, formed of eight characters and three words. Sambuddhena Pakasita. This is what the Buddhas come into this world to teach. Anicca, Dukkha and Anatta. In fact, that is what I am trying to expound to you. Anicca, Dukkha and Anatta. The whole concept of Anicca encompasses this idea of manifestation. Now if you take the dictionary, it will have various definitions for what manifestation means. So, I can't say that what I imply by manifestation might be exactly what it says in the dictionary, because you know there are no words in the dictionary that can describe what the Buddha taught us. In fact, there are no words, full stop, that can explain what the Buddha taught, because what the Buddha taught us was an understanding. You can attempt to encapsulate that understanding into words and phrases and sentences and paragraphs, but you know we'll always fail. What I'm trying to get across to you here, ladies and gentlemen, is an idea. And that idea is not necessarily the word that I use to convey the idea. So don't get bogged down with the words, is a key message I want to share with you right now. Don't get bogged down with the words. So just because you don't remember anicca, what was that Swami Nam said? Anitya, anicca, dukkha, which what was it? Oh, I can't remember. It's okay, don't worry, because I'm not going to give you a test on it later on. I told you, this is not a test. This is not a test of the Dhamma, this is a test of humanity. This is a test of how humane you are, not a test of the Dhamma. I'm not going to ask you what were those three words I taught you last week, don't worry. But I will ask you, what does your husband tell you about you now? What does your wife think about you now? That I will ask you. That I will ask you. So, manifestation. Let me try and explain to you what I mean by manifestation. In fact, that might be all we'll be able to talk about today. But that's okay. Because it's a very deep idea. I'll try. And I should ask you also to try. Okay? Try to stay awake. That's one of the ways you can try. You can't separate the causes from its effect. Take the fire example. If you take out the causes, do you have to do anything else to take out the fire? So you've taken out the oxygen, you've taken out the fuel, and you've taken out the temperature. Is there still a fire left for you to now deal with? No. But is the oxygen the fire? When you look at a fire, are you looking at oxygen? No. Is the fuel the fire? Is temperature the fire? So, but you only brought in oxygen, fuel and temperature. Where did fire come from? Did you bring a fire? So you brought in oxygen, here's a bit of oxygen, here's the fuel, here's the temperature, oh, by the way, here's the fire. Is that how you light the fire? Is it? No. So not once in a while, so I understand whether you understand what I'm saying, okay? So when I ask you, do you understand? You go either yes, or you go like this, or you go, You're not sure which one to say. So you half understand, half don't understand, right? So help me to help you. You don't have to shout things out, just give me a nod, so that's you don't embarrass yourselves, not worry. Only I can see you, nobody else is looking at you, I promise. Here's a question again. To light a fire, you bring oxygen, fuel, and you give temperature. Is oxygen the fire? Is fuel the fire? What about temperature? Is temperature the fire? No. Neither of these three things is the fire. If all you brought were these three things, where did the fire come from? Manifestation. That's a manifestation. And also bear in mind that there's more than you in this room. So therefore, some things I might have to go over several times, because although you understand it, not everyone has understood it. So sometimes I might go over several examples to talk about, to convey the same point. So please bear with us. When you take oxygen out, the fire goes out. Yeah? If you cut out the oxygen supply, the fire goes out. To take the fire away, or to take the fire out, to exterminate the fire, do you take the oxygen out and then also hide the fire? Do you take the fire with you somewhere? No, where did the fire go then? Where did it go? Did it go anywhere? No, what happened then? It stopped manifesting. It stopped manifesting. So is a fire something that comes from somewhere or goes somewhere? Can it come from somewhere? And can it go somewhere? Can it? No. It is not something that has, that comes from somewhere, and it is not something that goes anywhere. In fact, if you, you'd be, you know, when man first discovered fire, right, it would have been such a surprise, don't you think? You know, today we take it for granted, right, because all you got to do is just do that on a lighter and you have fire. But imagine when man first discovered fire. You know, they were like, perhaps they were just rubbing a stone on something, on another stone or something. Maybe they had some dry, you know, some grass or something somewhere, right? And, you know, just randomly doing something, and there was a spark. And then there was fire. Can you imagine how confused they must have been? They must have been like, where did that come from? Just think about it. Just, you know, take yourself there. Because there were only rocks. I had two rocks in my hand. There was some hay that had dried up. I was just rubbing these two rocks together. I never brought any fire. Where did the fire come from? Don't you think man would have been so confused? Because where did it come from? Because, you know, after it comes, wherever it comes from, you know, it seems to be doing a lot. It'll be there. It'll be there burning away, consuming everything in its way. It's so potent. You know, a fire can destroy anything in its way. So how come something so powerful came out of nowhere? Now people had a question. Where did it come from? Oh yeah, that's where it came from. The fire god. That's a short glimpse into history. How I imagine the fire god came into being. Because people didn't understand the concept of manifestation back then, you know. Today people do. But back then, they had no recognition of manifestation. Now, you know, when you bring some, like if you bring a jug of water, the water is there. No surprises. Yeah? If you bring some food, the food is there. If you mix the food and the water together, a soup is there. Yeah, that makes sense. But fire? Does it look like oxygen at least? I mean, the kid looks like its father, so no surprises. But a fire doesn't look like the oxygen. Does it look like the fuel? Does it look like temperature? I mean, temperature doesn't even look like anything. So how does fire take form? How does it have such color? How is it red? How is it orange? Where was the orange? Was it in the oxygen? Where was the red? Was it in the fuel? No. See how confused and perplexed people must have been back then? Because they didn't understand the concept of what? Manifestation. So you see, now we need to understand this idea of manifestation, because we need to use it a bit further down the line. Then that will bring the answer to this question. I may not be able to answer it fully today, but this is These are the questions that will be answered in future talks. So just hang in there. What's the answer to this question? What's the answer to this question? Hang in there. So manifestation is not the causes, but it is not separate from the causes. Take this desk for instance. Now unfortunately you can't see this desk. But you can imagine, take that desk for instance, the stool. Okay? So it has the top, it has the legs, it has a base, right? Which part of it is the stool? If I ask one of you to come here and touch the stool for me, which part would you touch? You have to touch the stool, not the legs, not the top, not the base, not the bushes. No, you can't touch, not the nails that are going to holding it together. You can't touch individual parts. I want you to touch and show me the stool. Where is the stool? Where's the stool? Then what is the stool? It's a manifestation. Can you separate the stool from its causes? In other words, let's say, I am not a stool thief, but I am a wood thief. Okay? So I come not on Sundays, because Sundays they expect me. I come on a Saturday when none of you are here. I like this stool, right? But I'm not a stool thief. I like the wood. So I take the wood with me. Can you now sue me on the basis that I have stolen a stool? Can you take me to court? Can you file a lawsuit against me and say, Swami Nohansi stole the stool? I didn't steal the stool. I only stole what? Wood. I never stole the stool. So if you ask me, you know, you see me running away with this. That's a ghastly sight, isn't it? Swami Nohansi running away. One arm, arms bowl, the other one stool. You see me running away with the stool, and you say, hey, Swami Nohansi, venerable sir, please leave the stool behind. The school needs it. I'm not going to leave any of this behind, because I'm not taking the stool with me. What am I taking? Good. You ask me to leave what? The stool. I tell you, okay. I haven't taken a stool with me, so I'm not going to be doing anything. I'm just going to run away. I won't stop. Can you complain that I have not listened to you? Or I'm not doing what you're suggesting me I do? All I'm taking with me is the wood. So where's the stool then? It's a manifestation. The stool is a manifestation. So is the stool the nails? Is the nails the stool? Are the nails the stool? Or is the stool the nails? What about the legs, the four legs? Are the four legs the stool? Or is the stool the four legs? What about the top? Is the top the stool? Or is the stool the top? What about the base? Which one is which? Now you understand that you can't answer these questions, because without talking about a manifestation, you can't talk about a stool. Yeah? Let's take another example. Now we talked about a rainbow. Let's take a rainbow. Now most of you will know how a rainbow appears in the sky, right? When there's water droplets in the air, sunlight falls on this, on the water drops, and refraction takes place, and then you see the rainbow. So what causes the rainbow? Light and water and refraction. So when light and water come into contact, refraction happens, and therefore you see the rainbow. Can you keep the light and the water on one side and take the rainbow away? Can you separate the rainbow from its causes? So is water the rainbow? Is light the rainbow? I'm not talking about the refracted light. I'm talking about the original light. Is light the rainbow? No. Is rainbow the light? Is rainbow the water? No. So what is the rainbow then? It's a manifestation. But you can't separate the effect from its causes. Because when the causes have aligned, now you see, it is not sufficient simply to have the causes. They have to come together in the right order. If I separated the top, the nails, the legs and the base and laid them out separately, an inch apart from each other, not a foot, just an inch apart from each other, would you say that's a stool? Would you? No, they're just the raw materials. Yeah, so it's not sufficient for there to be the causes. They have to line up. They have to come together in a particular order. Yeah, and that coming together in a particular order is very important. It is as important as the causes themselves. So if you laid out just the wood and the nails, the base, the top, side by side, is that a stool? No. But bring them together, what if you pile them all up, one on top of the other, is that a stool now? You just pile them all up, you throw it all into one bunch, is that a stool? No, that's not a stool either. It becomes a stool when you fix them in this order. What if, let's say, the top was directly on the base and the four legs were on top of that? Would you call that a stool? You see this? I'm suggesting something like this. This is the base, here's the top, and here are the legs. Is that a stool? You won't call that a stool. You would call that maybe a punishment equipment or something, a torture device. That's not a stool. So for there to be a stool, for a stool to manifest, they have to come together in the right order. Now you see here, the fire, for a fire to manifest, these causes have to come together in the right order. So you can't just have a bit of oxygen somewhere, a bit of fuel somewhere, right? And maybe it's hot, but you have the right temperature, but the fuel and the oxygen are not together. I mean, have you seen these large fuel tankers? You know, they have highly flammable written on the back of them, right? So what they're saying is, ensure that you don't have temperature and oxygen come into contact with it. Because you have the fuel, but then there is oxygen out there, okay? And it's a bit hot, perhaps, you know these tankers, they even travel in the deserts where it's hot. But what they don't have is the oxygen. So, because these three causes have not come together in the right order, a reaction doesn't take place. I'll give you another example. Your son, say he's 16 years old. There's a girl about his age next door. So there are causes. But you prevent the effect by doing what? by not bringing those causes together in the right order. What is the right order? They are together and you are not at home. So whenever they have a moment to meet each other, you ensure that either you or their parents are in their presence. By doing so, what are you preventing? An effect from manifesting. See? Manifestation. So it is not enough for there to be causes. They have to come together in the right order. A chitta is born in the same way. That is why when you don't like to see something, you close your eyes. Because one of the causes is for light to enter through your eyes and fall on the retina. That is one of the causes that has to happen. But that alone is not enough. Your optic nerve has to be functional. The optic portion of your brain has to be functional. The wires or the axons that conduct the electrical current, those have, they have to be functional. And the brain has to be functional enough so that it can generate a rupa-rupa, which is an image that it then drops on the mind base. All of that has to be functional. When all those causes line up, like the stars line up and you see the zodiac signs, yeah, when you look up at the sky on a starry night, you see Sagittarius, you see Aquarius, yeah, you see the star signs up there, right? So now, some of those stars, ladies and gentlemen, they're light years away. Did you know that? Yeah, these stars that you look up at the sky and you think, you know, they're just nicely evenly placed against each other. Far from it. Nothing could be further from the truth, because two of those stars are sometimes light years away. But you see the hunter when you look up at the sky on a starry night, a starry cloudless night, you see the hunter. Is there a hunter up there? Do you think those stars somehow had a conference somewhere? They decided, you know, on this fine day there's going to be someone who's going to come and look up at the sky. Let's all go and join hands and all stand together in this order so that when they look up at the sky they see the hunter. Do you think they did that? Certainly not. It was not their plan. They didn't plan for that. But when you look at the sky, you see a hunter. What is that phenomenon? Manifestation. You see a hunter when there is no hunter. That is a manifestation. Stool. All there is are causes lined up, configured, arranged in a particular fashion, in a particular order. You see a stool. Are you beginning to understand? I'll take another example. That is what, you know, we need examples to help us understand these concepts, right? That is my job. Try and simplify the Dhamma so that, because you only get once a week. I practice this every day. So it should be my job then and my duty to invest that time on your behalf as well as mine and bring it all so that I can give it to you in one teaspoonful. Here, drink this. Whereas in my lab, that's a big lab, I'm concocting all sorts of measures and I've got cylinders and barrels and measuring instruments and all sorts there in the lab. But here I just bring it to a spoon and say, drink this beta, drink it. Let's take another example. Take a fountain for instance. Right? You've all seen fountains. This is a body of water, and so usually there'll be a motor here, and that spits out water, right, at a certain speed. So what happens? Yeah, that's a fountain. Stop laughing. That's a fountain. That is a fountain. Whether you like it or not, that's a fountain. Okay. Right. So when you see a fountain, what are you actually looking at? Water. This is water. Well, so is this in my cup here. That is also water. But you don't look at this and go fountain. You just say this is just a mug of water. You look at this and you go fountain. See, same stuff, but a different arrangement. This is H2O as much as this is H2O. No different. The same raw materials, but arranged in a different order. You call this a fountain. What do you call this? Rain. Why do you call that a rain and this a fountain and this a cup of water? Same stuff, but different arrangement. So do you see now that the same stuff, when arranged differently, we give them different names? I mean, that makes life livable. Yeah, it makes life livable. Because you see, we use a characteristic about this situation to give this name. Rain is when water falls from the sky. Fountain is when water is spewed out of a motor or a siphon or some sort, and then it falls back on the ground into a body of water. This is fountain. The characteristic of a fountain. Characteristic of rain. Characteristic of a cup of water. Same stuff, different arrangement, because by characteristic they serve different purposes. Okay? I'm leading you on to something very profound. Like I said, the epiphany will happen in a moment. And then you'll begin to question, how am I so different from the person sat next to me? But right now you feel that identity. You feel that you are a very different person to sat next to you. You feel differences. Huh? You feel, I'm Sinhali, this guy is Tamil, this guy is Muslim, this guy is a Hindu, this guy is a Burger, this guy is a Jew. This guy's a male, this guy's a female. You feel all those differences. Soon enough, all that will wash away. And you realize that we're all just one. I don't perceive the differences that you perceive right now. In my eyes, you're just minds and bodies. Therefore, to me, my mother, as much as I care about her, I can care about all of you. As much as I care about my father, I care about all of you. Because to me, it's all the same. A mind and a body. Just rearranged. Different arrangements. All four or five people in your family, you all eat out of the same rice pot, don't you? Don't you? When you cook rice at home, you all eat out of the same rice pot, right? So one-fifth of that rice goes into making you. Another fifth of that rice goes into making your husband or your wife. Another fifth goes into making maybe your mother who stays with you. Another two-fifths go into making your children. Oh, and whatever is leftover is going to making the dog. Agreed? Take all that back and put into the rice pot. Now show me your mother, yourself, your children and your dog. Are they in the rice pot? Are they? No. But when consumed, you now perceive that they are all different beings, don't you? What was this question again? For a body to be there, you need a being. Really? Who said so? Mr. Bean? For a body to be there, you just need matter to be rearranged. You don't need a being for that. See, matter rearranged. You call this rain, you call this a fountain, you might call something else a spring. Just rearrange. Oh, another arrangement of this would be ice. Yes? Ice. But so are we raining? Is it raining ice? I mean, I know it rains ice, but I'm not talking about that. Is this raining ice? Is this fountain ice? No, you can't have an ice fountain. Because the characteristic of water that is required for there to be a fountain cannot coexist with its characteristic of being ice. Those two things are mutually exclusive. So do you see now, ladies and gentlemen, that in this world all you have is matter in various configurations, in various arrangements. So how is your body different to the next person's body? If you both ate at the same restaurant, if you both ate from the same rice pot, if you both ate from the same biscuit packet, do you think where they manufacture biscuits, they make biscuits, this one is going into making John, this is going to making Sam, this is going into making Jane? Do you think they pack them up in with names alongside? No, of course they don't. They just pack it up for consumption. The same biscuit that you eat, you can feed the dog. One biscuit goes into making your ear, the other goes into making the dog's tail. If you take the nutrients back and put it into a biscuit, now can you show me dog and human ear and dog tail? You can't, can you? So, are these differences really differences, or are they simply perceived differences? They are perceived differences because they are manifestations. That's why. So, to summarize for today, we'll continue this conversation in the next week if I'm here and if you're here. Because for that to manifest, for what to manifest? For next week's sermon to manifest, right? I should be in good health, at least alive. You should be in good health, at least alive. And we must all come here. This hall has to be able to accommodate us. Right? See how many causes need to line up for something so simple like this to happen? On the way here, if you get a flat tire, it might be that that's it for today. You can't join the sermon. You'll have to bring in the roadside assistance and they'll have to perhaps tow you back home. So to summarize, what is manifestation? When causes come together in the right order, when they align in the right order, it manifests. They manifest. What manifests? The effect manifests. That is how the principle of cause and effect works. So causes are not the same as effects. Effects are not the same as causes. They're different. Same, same, but different. They're the same, but they're not the same. They're different, but they're not different. But now you need to understand why I say so. If I ask you the question, are they the same? You can't have an answer right now. Now you can't have an answer because you have to ask me, what do you mean when you say the same, Swami, no answer? Or when I ask you, are they different? Then again you have to ask me the question, what do you mean, Swami, no answer, when you say they're different? See, now before you answer my question, you'll have to ask me a question in return. What do you mean? That is why last week I told you, when people went and asked the Buddha, Venerable Sir, is the self in the rupa? Is the rupa in the self? Is the rupa made of the self? Is the self made of the rupa? The Buddha didn't answer any of those questions. Because had he answered yes or no, in the negative or the affirmative, that man who asked the question would have gotten up and walked away as ignorant as he walked in. So the Buddha, in all his compassion and his infinite wisdom, he chose not to answer that question. But instead, he asked him to ask an even better question. He said, ask me, why you feel that the self is in the rupa? Or ask me, what is the cause of this self? Why? What is the cause of avidya? What is the cause of jati? What is the cause of upadana? Because those are the questions they asked. Either they asked about the parijasamuppada, or they asked about the skandhas, the five aggregates. Am I in the rupa? Am I in the vedana? Am I in the sanya sankhara vijnana? Or they would ask, am I in jati? Am I in bhava? Am I in upadana? Am I in tanha? Am I in vijnana? And so on. So wherever you look in the scriptures, these are the questions that they go and ask. This is called a tetralemma. If not the dilemma, this is a tetralemma or a quadrilemma. Is it in this or is it in that? Is it made of this? Is it made of that? You can't answer yes or no to any of these questions because they ask it out of ignorance. It's a bit like asking you, how tall is this camel that stood next to me? Tell me. This camel that is stood next to me, how tall is it? See, no matter which answer you give me, you can't help me, can you? If you tell me it's 10 foot tall, I walk away ignorant. The very fact that I'm asking you this question proves to you that I'm ignorant. Because I'm seeing something that you're not. In other words, there is no camel here. But I've gone insane. So I'm seeing a camel. I'm seeing an apparition. There's no camel here. What if you said it is not tall? You're still talking about it. You're talking about a camel that does not exist. So I walk away thinking you don't know what the heck I'm talking about. Have you helped me? No. That is why you should ask me this instead. why do you think there is a camel here? When you ask me that question, I tell you why I think there's a camel here. I might tell you because something's rubbing against my shoulder, so I think it's a camel. Then you have to ask me, why do you think something's rubbing against your shoulder? So you keep asking me questions until I come to my own realization that there is no camel here. That is the only way out of this. Realization has to happen within you. I can't give you realizations. I can only ask the right questions. That is what a good teacher always does. They never give us the answers. They only ask the right questions. And the answer comes from within us. Because when the answer comes from within you, it is your answer. There are no doubts, no suspicions, no skepticism, nothing. You believe your answer. So lastly, what is manifestation again, before we wrap up for the day? When the causes line up in the right order, and the effect manifests. Okay, so we took the example of a water fountain. This is causes lining up in this order. This is water lining up in this order. This is water lined up in this order. One you call a mug of water, the other you call a fountain, the other you call rain. So the same causes lined up in different ways gives you a different effect, because they manifest a different effect. Enough for one Sunday? Right, we'll continue next week then. Alright, let's take a moment then to transfer the merits and bring today's talk to a close. So, don't forget this subliminal messaging. Alright, let's all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, inviting the Mahasangha to deliver a sermon today, listening to the sermon, as well as making it possible for others to come and join in and listen to the talk, in making their stay here comfortable, in providing them with food, water, refreshments and so on. Let us transfer all these merits to those who deserve it. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we must be. To the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters, who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that amongst them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries, who have always been by your sides through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the other monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our teachers, and those who helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. And by the power of these merits, may they also be healed of any physical and mental ailments, overcoming obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain themselves from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the friends of the monastery and our devotees, who make great efforts to provide shelter, foods, arms and robes to the Mahasangha. They do this in the name of merits, for the sake of merits, to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, as well as those who help and support the mission of promoting the Dhamma by passing on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, May they be healed of any physical and mental ailments, overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress, abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill them in Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sankadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and protect and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us also remind ourselves that there will be our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way, and may they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to those who go to great lengths and sacrifice their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. Members of the armed forces, as well as the police force, as well as those who would have lost their lives in the wars, be their friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to those who would have passed away in our name, our ancestors, and those who have predeceased us. It is by the fruits of their labor, their blood, their sweat and their tears that today we enjoy the comforts of life that we do. May they all rejoice in these merits. Out of gratitude, let us, out of compassion, pass these merits on to them as well. Let us also remind ourselves and transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities, catastrophes such as the tsunamis and landslides, fires, blizzards, pandemics and so on. Reminding ourselves that in this infinite long journey of samsara, they will all have been friends and family to us, and will have gone to great lengths to help us, provide for us and shelter us. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I, and everyone who has helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Vahanse, or an Arahat Teranin Vahanse, in this life itself, and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnendatnva dvesha ginnendatnva moha ginnendatnva nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita Taravatma Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravatma Mama da Siyalu Loka Siyalu Satmayo Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravatma Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravatma Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravatma Raga Gini Niveva Dvesha Gini Niveva Moha Gini Niveva Nivansapa Nivansapana Deva Nivansapana Deva Tunuruvange Suvisi Ananta Maha Gunabelin Siru Loka Siru Satyavama Nibbana Paramasukhen Suvisi Paravetva Sadhu Sadhu Sadhu.